would not be the same. A few people laughed. A few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
Navy administration goes to the leaders of Bikini Atoll, which eventually became one of the Ground Zero testing sites, and brought together the community and sat them down and said, you know, we want you to be involved in helping us do something that will bring peace to the world, and God wants us to do this, you know, sort of drawing on the fact that it was the divine right of the U.S. to test and to have these weapons.
While 67 devices were reportedly detonated in that period, the extent of the nuclear insult, for lack of a better word, the yield of those tests has been estimated at 1.7 Hiroshima shots every day for 12 years. We in the Marshalls, covering an area just under 1 million square miles of ocean, were the direct, the ground zero, extended ground zero of the atomic bomb tests.
Me, the entire test series, when you fired one of those damn things off once, okay, they work, they're terrible, let it go at that. I don't see the need for continued testing and continued development. But I'm just one voice in the wilderness.
The nuclear weapons, you know. The sooner you get rid of these suckers, the better it is, really, for the whole world community.
It was the first day of March, 1954. While the colours of the rising sun began to play over the skies of a still Pacific morning, a second sun suddenly and furiously erupted from Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands. The tempest it unleashed had been driven by the unflinching determination of nuclear physicist Edward Teller to bequeath to the world a weapon as powerful as the sun itself, a weapon fueled by the fusion of hydrogen atoms. Within 1 second of that infernal detonation, an immense fireball, 7 kilometers in diameter, had formed. 8 minutes later, the fiery cloud had billowed upwards far beyond the ozone layer and had reached the stratosphere, 40 kilometers above the atoll. By then, the cloud was over 100 kilometers wide. Even so, it continued expanding outwards at a rate of over 360 kilometers an hour. Beneath this fiery monster, the Bikini Atoll had been cleaved in two by a gaping crater, 2 kilometers wide and nearly 200 feet deep. The clever men who had worked so hard to bring this to fruition were well pleased. The 80,000 inhabitants of the Marshall Islands, which had become part of what the US military had claimed as the Pacific Proving Grounds, were, however, to be smitten for generations to come. Wongalap Atoll lay 170 kilometers to the east of Bikini. That morning, the sky lit up as it had never lit up before. The atoll shuddered as from an earthquake, and a horrific roar filled the air. Soon after, white flakes began to fall from the sky and covered everything with a layer of ash an inch thick. The sky turned a ghastly grey, and families gathered together, wondering what had happened.
In 1946, the Navy pulled into the harbor, the lagoon in Bikini, and went ashore and told the people there that the United States would like to use their atoll as a testing site for atomic bombs. This very direct approach was well rehearsed. The team that went there to quote-unquote seek the permission of the natives couched it in terms of something that was the will of God, that it was a call from God for the people of Bikini to sacrifice for the peace and security of the world.
Here was a powerful group of people who had just gotten rid of a very tyrannical Japanese regime, which had been very brutal during the wartime. And they had a lot of faith in their new friends. And so when their new friends asked for permission to utilize their land to bring peace to the world, it was without a full understanding of what the impacts of nuclear weapons would do.
The Bravo test was a huge nuclear blast. It was a hydrogen bomb of about 15 megaton power, which is an unbelievable amount. I've got to dig into my memory here, but I think that the Hiroshima bomb was about 20 kilotons, 20,000 tons. This is the equivalent of 15 million tons of TNT going off. And it was on an atoll. It was a surface burst right on the reef. And it blew a huge crater and just literally vaporized forget what the cubic mileage of it is, but it was a couple of miles across and 600 feet deep, something like that. This huge divot cut out, and all that water and coral and so forth was vaporized and went up with the cloud and drifted downwind and then fell out looking somewhat like snow on the Rongelapis and on another island, a bunch of islanders, downwind.
When the radioactive ash fell from the nuclear detonation, the people thought it was snow in many cases. You know, I interviewed people who said that they went out and played in it because they had always heard about snow or seen pictures of snow, but they'd never experienced it before. So when the white powder or ash fell from the sky, they went out, you know, kids put it on their eyes like makeup or on their lips like lipstick. Some people tasted it and wanted to see how it smelled and put it in their pockets or brought it home. And so they really didn't have an understanding of the dangers because the U.S. hadn't conveyed that to them before.
The day began, as always, the men to fish in their outriggers, the mothers cooking and digging taro, gathering plantains and watching over the children, who played at fishing and gathering and ran and played tag. Suddenly from the sky fell white powder. Once a missionary had told of snow. Perhaps this was snow. It came down, covering everything. It was sticky. We played and scooped it up and threw it at each other. It was fun. That evening, I did not feel so well. My eyes hurt and my stomach turned to water. My brother's body was covered with blisters and his skin began to fall off. Mother was vomiting too, and her beautiful hair began to come out in hands full. Mother wondered if it was the snow, so she washed us, but the water was filled with snow and the scrubbing removed the skin. Soon the whole village was sick, and the animals and the plants, all were sick. After 2 days, the strange men came in boats with a large mouth which dropped open on the beach, and white-clad creatures came out. They wore masks with strange eyes and a long, round mouth. They pointed sticks at us, which buzzed and crackled. They pointed the sticks at everything, the trees, the wells, the fish, and listened to the buzz and crackle, then made marks on little boards they carried. Finally, they left, but told us we were very sick, and not to eat of the fish, the coconuts, the plantains, the taro, that they were now taboo. The men returned in their large boats and said our island was now taboo. They gathered us up, leaving everything behind. We were taken to another place where we were poked and bled. We looked so terrible that the people must have been afraid. They wore the strange white suits when they looked in on us. My brother looked the worst, like an old man with scabs, which broke and bled and his teeth fell out, and then he was dead. Mama became an old woman with patchy hair and always a sickness. Each time she saw me, she cried. I was so sick, so tired, and then one day I died.
Murder,
Following the Bravo event in 1954, the United States set up a top secret medical program that was called Project 4.1. And Project 4.1 was to study the effects of radiation on human beings. Prior to this time, the United States had conducted lots of medical experiments exposing animals like lab rats to radiation and understanding what radiation would do to these animals. But the Marshall Islands became an opportunity for the U.S. to take it to the next step, to understand what radiation would do to human beings. And so there were aspects of purposeful exposure of Marshallese to radiation for the purpose of scientific study, with the idea that if the U.S. was ever in a nuclear war, the U.S. needed to understand how its citizens would fare, or if U.S. soldiers were sent into a nuclear exchange, the U.S. government would know how the soldiers would survive. And so the Marshallese did become human test subjects to study the effects of radiation.
Apparently, the plan for a study was made a year before Bravo, which makes the accident of Bravo somewhat suspect. If they were planning a year before to set up both control groups and exposed groups a year before the test, then that to me means that the claim that Bravo was bigger than they expected and that the winds changed at the last minute, which they did not. They knew where the winds were blowing. It's, you know, typical governmental horse feathers.
The Bravo test caused an enormous amount of radiation on the island. The kids were standing on the beach one morning, and the sun came up in the west, and then it started to snow flakes, and they were all wondering, what the heck is this then? They've been used like guinea pigs, you know. They needed people to see the result, because it was all always new. This whole radiation in people is still a valid issue today, you know.
Rongelap was an atoll that the closest inhabited atoll to Bikini, the ground zero location. And so when the U.S. was getting ready to detonate the Bravo shot on March 1st, 1954, previously for much smaller shots, the U.S. had relocated the Rongelapese as a precautionary measure, taken them off of their homelands while they conducted these tests, just to remove them from harm's way. But then on the day that the U.S. had decided, okay, they're getting ready to test their largest weapon ever, they purposely decided to leave the Rongelapese there. Also, weather accounts from the morning and the evening before the test shot show that the winds were blowing towards Rongelap, and that the U.S. government was aware of that, and that the winds were blowing exactly from the test site to Rongelap. On the eve of the Bravo test, there was also a U.S. naval ship that was anchored right at Rongelap. And that naval ship stayed when the Bravo shot was detonated. And then when it began to pick up the radiation cloud that was moving towards Rongelap and confirmed that radiation had come to Rongelap, that ship took off. It left, and it left without taking the people of Rongelap with it. There had been an opportunity. They could have removed the Marshallese and evacuated them from Rongelap, but they didn't. And then once this community of Rongelap had been exposed to the radiation, the U.S. government left them there for about 2 days before coming in and evacuating them. And then the U.S. came in and evacuated them and moved them to Kwajalein Atoll, which was a military base at the time, put them in a barbed wire and camp, a barbed wire fenced off area where the U.S. doctors came in and enrolled them into this top secret medical program, Project 4.1, without their knowledge or without their consent. And this project became a study to monitor what radiation would do to the people. you know, not treating them, not taking care of their illnesses as, you know, a normal doctor-patient relationship would be, to try to improve the health or well-being of the subjects. But this was to take photographs of, you know, what did the burns in the skin look like, and then to watch it over time to really understand what the effects would be. You know, they had burns that went down to their bones, where the bones were visible, and their feet, they were in agony. And all the U.S. would do was take pictures of their illnesses, and, you know, without giving them painkillers, without giving them treatments. It was, you know, they understood right from the beginning that they were like test subjects. And it's interesting because the Marshallese had to, again, going back to the language, they had to borrow a term from the English language to sort of convey these experiences as research subjects. And now you hear Marshallese talk about being guinea pigs. And that animal, the guinea pig, doesn't exist in the Marshall Islands. But that term is needed to convey the dehumanization that they felt as being test subjects. It's not just the Marshallese who are alive during the testing period. You know, certainly the people who were alive then suffered incredible burdens and probably suffered the most out of all the Marshallese. But this isn't an issue that's gone away. It's not just a historical event, because the violence of the testing program is imprinted in the DNA of the people, and they carry it on. You know, for instance, a woman has her full supply of eggs in her body when she's born. And so when your eggs begin to get exposed to radiation, that's all your reproductive potential that gets affected. And so in the Marshall Islands, you see second, third generation effects. And, you know, as an anthropologist, I've done a lot of interviewing with the Marshallese, and talking particularly with the women who've been exposed to radiation. And, you know, certainly the reproductive abnormalities have been one of the most acute experiences for the Marshallese, and certainly one of the saddest, most disturbing events.
I can't read those tests. I just can't. Just thinking about it now chokes me up. To read, governmentese of the number, you know, kind of regretting the fact that their control groups weren't accurate enough to be absolutely certain they were right in testing the mortality of these exposed groups. And, you know, cold-bloodedly saying, well, you know, if we had a better laboratory set up, we'd be able to tell, but now we could just estimate from the fact that how many stillborns or how many few are born than would normally be born in a population of that size. And, you know, so it's, well, we'll watch them, and if they're not having many kids, that means that there's a lot of problems. And if they're having a lot of malformed children and so forth, then that's a problem. And we'll just statistically analyze it. And unfortunately, I can't do that, because I keep putting myself in the place of the poor beggars that are over there as the testees. And, like I say, I'm sorry, I just can't read it.
The Marshall Islands government had asked me to conduct oral histories with a lot of the people and communities who were downwind from the nuclear weapons testing. And I began to focus quite a bit on the women as a result. I think of, you know, me being a woman and having access to the women made it, I guess a likely research project. And so what the women began to tell me, this certain theme started to emerge as I talked to them. I probably did more than 200 interviews with folks who were directly downwind from the testing program. But the women in particular would talk about you know, how before the testing program, Marshallese had always had stillbirths or miscarriages because they had always existed, you know, as they do in any human population. But after their exposure to radiation, they started to give birth to what they considered almost non-human offspring that they had never seen before. And what was interesting is embedded in the language are clues about these new reproductive abnormalities. That the women had to devise an entirely new language, really, to describe what they were giving birth to, because the Marshallese language never had these words before, because they had never been exposed to radiation before, so they didn't need them. And so women started talking about giving birth to grape babies. And grape babies are, you know, in English we call them hydatiform molar pregnancies, which are extremely rare. You know, they're maybe about one in a million. The thyroid, there's been a lot of thyroid illness and thyroid cancer that's been associated with the radiation exposure. There have been a lot of cancers in the Marshall Islands. Again, we know when people are exposed to radiation that radiation is cancer-causing. And so there's a high incidence of cancer throughout the Marshall Islands. The testing ended in 1958. Still today, there's no oncologist in the Marshall Islands. And so there's no, if you get cancer in the Marshall Islands today, and you know, in 2012, there's no chemotherapy that's available in the Marshall Islands. There's no oncologist that you can go to and talk to about cancer treatment. There's no facility in the Marshall Islands to deal with your cancer. And so cancer can essentially be a death sentence for the Marshallese, and it's only those that have the means or the wealth or the ability or the family connections to get themselves out of the country to find treatment elsewhere who have the best chances of survival.
The radiation on the island is still four times higher than it permissible in the United States, and the United States has this year they told the Rongelap people that they have to return, otherwise all the funding to them will stop. So here we are, you know, 25 years later, after their evacuation, here's the United States putting pressure on people to go back to their island, which we know is four times higher than permissible in the United States. And I think, Jesus, the nuclear weapons, you know, the sooner you get rid of these suckers, the better it is, really, for the whole world community.
When all the trees have gone, and all the rivers dried, don't despair when all the flowers have died. For I have heard that there's a garden somewhere